Oracle Network. Look deeper.
Well, hey there, friends, and welcome to the first Beyond the Mask episode for 2021. I'm very excited about this one because I get to cover one of my, well, I guess favorite is an odd choice of words considering the topic, but it is one of my favorite horror films. It's also one of my favorite black comedies. I'm talking about 1999's Ravenous, starring Guy Pearce and Robert Carlyle, among a few other well-known faces. It's not necessarily a household name in terms of horror films, but this one hit me like a lightning bolt when I first saw it over 20 years ago. For those of you old enough, remember when we would get those tiny little HBO magazines in the mail that would tell you what was playing on that channel for the entire month? And, well, for those of you who don't remember that, I hate to break it to you, but not everything was left up to the press of a button or readily available on our phones. And you better believe that I would scour through those pages to see what was playing, and I remember seeing the title, Ravenous. Just that one word, and that's really all it took, because the word ravenous, it incited thoughts in my head of, you know, extreme hunger, extreme desire. It's something that, for whatever reason at that time, definitely piqued my interest as a 13-year-old, and of course, obviously, I decided that I needed to see it. So I remember looking and making sure that I knew what time it was coming on. And of course, it was on way past my bedtime. But being the somewhat tenacious child that I was, I crept out of my bedroom that night a few minutes before it was to come on. I slowly walked down the stairs to our living room where our TV was and began to watch it. And I remember it didn't frighten me. Instead, I was intrigued. I wasn't too familiar with cannibalism. I knew what it was. I'd heard vague things about it, under the breath rumblings about the Donner Party and some tragic, horrific cannibalism that may or may not have taken place. But, you know, it's not exactly a topic that was heavily covered in a seventh grade history class. But it captured me. And I would actually literally sneak downstairs in the middle of the night at least two or three more times to watch it. I was hooked, huddled on the couch under a blanket, the volume turned up so that it was barely audible. It was probably set to, I don't know, one or two, but I didn't want to wake up my parents. Sorry, Mom and Dad, if you're listening to this. Yes, I did sneak down and watch possibly inappropriate cannibal movies in the middle of the night, but given what I'm doing now, does that really surprise you? Probably not. And not long after I watched it for the first time, I found myself wanting to learn more about cannibals because, well, eating people is pretty much a taboo concept. And obviously, the film, if you've seen it, it shows a bit more of a sadistic approach to it rather than one of survival or cultural acceptance, but it interested me all the same. And that's when I really began to learn more about the Donner Party and their ill-fated 1846 journey to California, as well as its very loose connection to this film. So I hope you're ready for this one. Hold on tight, my friends. This is Beyond the Mask. We'll be right back. In the late 1800s, the gold rush had fully hit the United States. So many people were choosing to look west to California in pursuit of striking it rich, expanding America westward, albeit not without issues of its own, primarily the disregard for Native Americans who were already settled there and claimed the land as theirs, which it was, because they lived there first. But in April 1846, a group of pioneers decided to travel to California from Illinois in search of a better life. James Fraser Reed was a businessman from Illinois and was the leader of the group at the start. He, along with his family, which included his wife Margaret and their four children, Virginia, James, Thomas, and Patty, were convinced that they were destined for riches in California. Along with the Reed family, Margaret's mother Sarah Keyes and two of their servants piled into their wagon. And at the time, Sarah was very ill from tuberculosis, but she decided to make the journey with her daughter and her family because she didn't want to be without her daughter. James was very successful and had an extravagant wagon basically built to transport his family. It was a, quote, two-story affair with a built-in iron stove, spring-cushioned seats, and bunks for sleeping. Taking 8 oxen to pull the luxurious wagon, Reed's 12-year-old daughter Virginia dubbed it the Pioneer Palace Car, end quote. In addition to the Reeds, other families also joined in. The Breens, Murphys, Eddies, Keysbergs, Wolffingers, Jacob and George Donner, who assisted Reed in leading the group. There were other individuals, bachelors, teamsters who worked for some of the families that joined in as well. There were 9 covered wagons and nearly 35 people who set out on this journey. Leaving Springfield, Illinois on April 16th, they began heading west and had a 2,500-mile trek in front of them, which would take them through parts of the country that were pretty unfamiliar. The goal was to leave in the spring and arrive at their destination well before the winter months hit, as traveling through mountain passes and unforgiving plains in the snow would be just a little bit more than troublesome. Before they left, James Reed had read a book called The Emigrant's Guide to Oregon and California, written by Lansford W. Hastings. In the book, Hastings described a shortcut that claimed to save travelers almost 400 miles during their journey and that the terrain was easily passable for animals and wagons. The problem with this is that it was complete and utter bullshit. Hastings had never completed a trip through this shortcut and blindly wrote about it, giving pioneers hope that this was a substantial burden to be lifted off of them by saving them time and energy with this shortcut. And of course, describing a shortcut that would save that much time would, of course, be extremely enticing to anyone traveling west, especially to those with children and ill mother-in-laws like James Reed. Additionally, in a cruel twist of irony, quote, on the very day that the Illinois party headed west from Springfield, Lansford Hastings prepared to head east from California to see what the shortcut he had written about was really like, end quote. On the day the group left Springfield, there was a flurry of emotions, excitement at a potentially promising future, fear from the unknown challenges that lay ahead, and of course sadness because they were leaving some of their friends behind as well as their homes. Virginia said, quote, my father, with tears in his eyes, tried to smile as one friend after another grasped his hand in a last farewell. Mama was overcome with grief. At last, we were all in the wagons, the drivers cracked their whips, the oxen moved slowly forward, and the long journey had begun, end quote. The group believed it would take about 4 months to reach California, but within weeks of their departure, it was clear that that estimation may be more difficult to achieve than they thought, as weather proved to be a feisty hindrance in keeping the team on schedule. As the group passed through Independence, Missouri, they were joined by more travelers, believing that, of course, larger numbers traveling in a pack were safer and more helpful. And so the group continued to expand until they had almost 90 people heading along on the California Trail. By May 25th, the group had reached the Big Blue River in Kansas, but the achievement was marked with tragedy. as the group waited for high water in the river to subside and make it passable, Sarah Keyes succumbed and died from tuberculosis and was buried near the river. Colonel William H. Russell, who had joined the wagon train in Independence and had also been acting as the wagon train captain, chose to step down at this time and was replaced by William H. Boggs. The group continued. They were making somewhat steady progress and eventually reached Fort Laramie, Wyoming on June 27, 1846, which was about a week later than they had originally intended. 2 months into their journey, and they were less than halfway to their final destination. As they resupplied and took a short rest at Fort Laramie, James Reed actually met up with his friend, James Kleiman, who was traveling east from California. Kleiman, who was a seasoned traveler, told Reed how he had just traveled the Hastings route and basically urged Reed not to take that route after Reed told him that that's exactly what they were planning to do. Kleiman, after traveling through on foot, relayed how difficult it had been. It was nearly impassable for those on foot, let alone with an entire wagon train, and he told him just how trying the journey was through Eastern California and the Sierra Nevadas. Reed listened to his friend, but ultimately decided against his recommendation and decided to attempt the Hastings route anyway. Now, in my opinion, that's just stupid. By chance, you happen to see a friend of yours, someone that you trust, someone who, why would he lie to you? And he tells you how hard his journey was going through the exact same pass that you're planning to take wagons and oxen and tons of people through. And he tells you that it'll be more difficult than it's worth. It's not possible, and you choose to ignore him. That level of arrogance is astounding to me. Like, again, why would he lie to you? He wouldn't be bragging about how hard it was to make himself seem like he's that much tougher or whatever. And getting to California that much sooner, supposedly, if you take this route, is it really worth the bragging rights? I don't think so. But Reed, the Donners, the rest of the group, they made plans to depart and were going ahead with the Hastings route. And they actually, before they departed, received a letter from Hastings himself telling them that he would meet them in Fort Bridger, Wyoming, and take them through his supposed shortcut. So with this new information, Reed and the others believed now that they had an even better chance of getting through the Hastings route because this was the man who had supposedly discovered the shortcut. But oh, how wrong they were. The group set out again, and by July 19th, they reached the Little Sandy River in Wyoming. Now, this is where the California Trail diverged into two separate paths. One was the tried and tested remainder of the California Trail. The other directed travelers south towards Fort Bridger and the Hastings Cutoff. The group then faced a decision, and most of them decided to stick with the California Trail because it had already been taken by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other travelers. It was by far the safer choice, but some, however, decided to take a chance and go with the more southern route, and at this point, George Donner emerged as the group's leader. As this group arrived in Fort Bridger on July 28th, they expected to be met by Lansford Hastings, but he was nowhere to be found. Instead, they were greeted with a note that stated Hastings was already out on the trail, having departed with another group, and that the Donner Party should try to catch up to them. They were further reassured to take the path by Jim Bridger and Louis Vasquez, who both claimed that the Hastings Cutoff was safe, good for travel, and of course, faster than the regular route. But of course, none of these people, including Hastings, who are claiming that this cutoff is safe, able to be traveled, all that jazz, have actually done it. The only person who has done it is James Kleiman, and he said that it was basically impassable, but for whatever reason, Reed and everybody else chose to ignore the one man who had actually taken the route because everybody else lied to them. So at this point, the group decided to rest for a few days at Fort Bridger. They stocked up on supplies and made the necessary preparations for what they anticipated to be about a 7-week journey on this trail. On July 31st, the Donner Party departed, having been joined by the McCutcheon family, which brought the group's total up to 74 people. Within a week, they had covered a little more than 700 miles and eventually arrived at the Weber River on August 6th. Here, the group was faced with another decision. When they arrived at the river, they found a note attached to a post from Hastings, who explicitly told them that the current path that they were on wasn't recommended for the 20-wagon train and that they should take the Hastings cutoff. Now, my question here is, if Hastings has this cutoff, why didn't he direct this other group that he was with through the pass? It doesn't make any sense, but that didn't seem to be a thought for anybody in the Donner Party. James Reed and two other men even rode ahead to catch up to Hastings and confirm what he had written. And when Reed found Hastings, they were on the southern shore of the Great Salt Lake, and Hastings actually escorted Reed and his two other men back to where he could point out that new route for him, the cutoff. So the rest of the party was waiting for Reed to return, and they were joined by another family, the Graves family. They met up with them and decided to join the train. And when Reed and his men returned, he told the group what Hastings had recommended, which he had estimated should take the group about a week to cross, and they put it to a vote. Unfortunately, they still decided to go with this new route, and that was basically because the only other option was to backtrack to Fort Bridger and take the other route, something that was probably safer and wouldn't have ended in tragedy, but nobody wanted to go back and waste all that time heading backwards when they knew that time was against them and the snow would be coming in a matter of months and they just needed to continue moving forward. On August 11th, the Donner Party began their journey, traveling through the Wasatch Mountains, and they soon realized that Hastings hadn't been completely right about the ease of his new trail. Hastings was basically treating these people like guinea pigs. Instead of doing it himself, he was basically convincing other people to do it for him, and honestly, a lot of people blame the Donners and Reed for what happened, and while they are partially to blame because they decided to move forward, Hastings is the one who is ultimately responsible for what would happen to the Donner Party. The group had to frequently stop to clear trees and create a movable path, which obviously caused more of a challenge than they anticipated. There were obstructions, trees, boulders, things like that, that greatly slowed down the group's momentum, and they went from covering about 10 to 12 miles in a day to barely hitting 2 miles, if that, in a day. Nearly a week into the trip, they had only covered 8 miles, and by the time they reached the Humboldt River on September 26th, a journey that Hastings said would take a week, the Donner Party had spent nearly 6.5 weeks traveling 125 miles, which included an 80-mile trek through the Salt Lake Desert. Over the course of this 125 miles, they had to ditch multiple wagons. They lost 32 oxen. They either died or some of them ran away. One man named Luke Halloran died from tuberculosis, and of course their supplies were dangerously low because this supposed one-week journey took them nearly 7 times that long, and morale was in the gutter. Many of them were blaming not only Hastings for misleading them, but James Reed as well for convincing them to do it. Once they reached the Humboldt River, this put them back on the California Trail and off of the Hastings cutoff. So for a moment, they felt like they were again on the right path. They followed the river for a couple weeks, and as time went on, more and more of the group became disgruntled about the journey and how much time they had wasted with this new trail. On October 5th, tempers exploded. Quote, two wagons became entangled and John Snyder, a teamster of one of the wagons, began to whip his oxen. Infuriated by the teamster's treatment of the oxen, James Reed ordered the man to stop, and when he wouldn't, Reed grabbed his knife and stabbed the teamster in the stomach, killing him, end quote. To the rest of the group, this was unacceptable, and together they were determined to punish Reed. And at this point, I don't think it's just for killing this man. They wanted to punish him for delaying their journey, for making it harder than it needed to be. And several members of the group, including Lewis Kiesberg, voted to hang Reed, but the majority voted to simply banish him. So James Reed was forced to leave his family and ride west, accompanied by Walter Heron, who was one of Reed's teamsters. As the Donner Party continued, they were exhausted, the animals were exhausted, and soon people began having to make unthinkable decisions. On October 7th, Lewis Kiesberg decided that his older traveling companion, a man named Hardcoop, was simply becoming too weak to keep up. Hardcoop's feet were extremely swollen, and for whatever reason, no one offered to let the man ride in their wagons and rest, so Kiesberg made the decision to just leave him sitting alone under a sagebrush, most likely to die. And 5 days after that, they were attacked by a group of Native Americans, and 21 people died, as well as many of their animals. Now, while all of this was going on, two men from the group, Charles Stanton and William McCutcheon, had been sent to Fort Sutter to fetch supplies and bring them back, but McCutcheon had fallen ill and remained at Fort Sutter, while Stanton decided to head on back, leave McCutcheon at the fort, head on back, return the supplies, and on October 9th, he arrived and came with beef and flour, as well as two Miwok Indian guides named Lewis and Salvador. These men were going to help guide them through the Sierra Nevadas, and instead of continuing with their journey, knowing full well that time was definitely against them and that much colder, harsher weather would soon be upon them, the group decided to rest for 5 days, which, again, it only put them at a disadvantage. This is now late October, so they have a matter of weeks, theoretically, before the snow starts coming. But by October 28th, the snow began to fall. Heavy snow began to blanket the wilderness and impede their progress. Around the same time, James Reed arrived at Fort Sutter and met up with William McCutcheon, who was basically recovered at this point, and Reed made plans to head back for the group to get his family. More and more tragedies befell the Donner Party. George Donner and his group fell behind when his wagon axle broke, and then he cut his hand while chopping down wood to fix the axle. The Donner Party now had split into two groups, and the other group continued on and came across Truckee Lake, which is now known as Donner Lake. But as they reached the lake, another huge snowstorm came through, blanketing snow on the ground as far as they could see. And after a failed attempt to reach the Sierra Pass, they stopped on the eastern side of the lake and decided to try to wait out the storm. There was already one cabin there, but they built two more so that it could house all 59 of the people in that group, and only planned to remain there until the snow melted enough for them to pass. George Donner and his 22 travelers were held up at Alder Creek, and with the ever-falling snow deepening around them, they had to basically bunker down and huddle in whatever makeshift housing they could create. They used blankets, they tried to construct some tents, but they didn't have the materials that the other group had, so they couldn't build cabins or anything like that. The group at Truckee Lake eventually realized that there was no chance of them getting through the Sierra Pass over the winter, so they were stuck there for the winter and decided to build more cabins, but also knew that they did not have nearly enough supplies to last the months that they would have to be there. So fear began to sink in. They ended up killing their oxen and mules for food, but it only lasted so long. Eventually, they resorted to eating twigs and bark, really anything they could find or dig up. At this point, James Reed and William McCutcheon were still trying to reach the group, but again, the weather made the journey basically impossible because there was anywhere from 20 to 25 feet of snow on the ground, so they were forced to return to Fort Sutter and wait it out, but assumed that the group still had plenty of livestock to sustain them through the harsh winter months because they didn't know that their journey through the Hastings Cutoff had caused them to lose 32 of their oxen. By mid-December, members of the group were so malnourished that their bodies just couldn't hold on any longer, and people began to die. On December 15th, Bayless Williams died, which further frightened the group into realizing that if something wasn't done soon, they would all meet the same fate. A small part of the group left, 15 in total, and they chose to snowshoe 100 miles to Fort Sutter, but the harsh weather, the fact that they were extremely weak both in body and mind, and barely had enough supplies, soon caused many of the people in the group to die. When the surviving members made it through the mountain pass on January 19, 1847, they arrived at a ranch, and the true horror of what had happened was revealed. Only 7 people made it out of the 15 that left, and this is now referred to as the Forlorn Hope. And these 7 people had survived by cooking and eating the corpses of those who had died along the way, after basically exhausting every other option for nourishment. It's also said that the 2 Miwok guides went with this group, and after they saw that the group was basically resorting to eating the dead, they refused and ran away because they believed that if they stayed, they would most likely be sacrificed for food. And they weren't wrong. They ran away, but they were eventually tracked down by William Foster, who murdered the guides, and they were eaten by the rest of the group. A little over 2 weeks after their arrival, a rescue group left on February 5th, hoping to find the remaining members of the Donner Party alive, but they were cautiously optimistic at this point. James Reed volunteered to head up another group and left on February 7th. By February 19th, the first group reached Truckee Lake and were horrified at what they found. At first glance, the camp looked abandoned, but they soon found that there were 48 survivors there, starving, going mad from isolation. They were desperate for survival, and out of those survivors, 23 were escorted first back to Fort Sutter with the first party, which included James Reed's family. And Reed ended up passing this party on his way towards the camps. And he was overcome with emotion at the sight of his wife and children because they had survived. Out of all of the families that embarked on this journey, only Reed's family and the Breens would emerge without having lost a single family member. Reed and his search party continued to the lake, arriving on March 1st, and they were, of course, shocked at seeing the butchered remains of several deceased party members. They continued on to Alder Creek, hoping for better news at that camp, but when they arrived on March 2nd, Reed and his team were met with similar results. They found that many of the travelers had perished, and those who had perished had been cannibalized. The following day, the rescue party took 17 of those survivors and left the camp, and of course, this was the first glimmer of hope for these people in months, but it was soon shattered when the group got caught in a blizzard. Unfortunately, this was too much for most of the group to endure, and one man named Isaac Donner died in the storm, and all but basically 3 of them remained there. They set up what was later referred to as the starved camp. They were too weak to go any further. So Reed's team and the 3 members who were still strong enough to do the journey continued on. They were hoping to find any kind of food along the way and bring it back to the starved camp, but they didn't find anything, and they were heading back down to Fort Sutter while the other remaining members were soon greeted by another rescue party on March 12th. During that time, 2 more people had died, and those, along with Isaac Donner, had been cooked and eaten. As the rescue team continued on to the lake and then to Alder Creek, they were met by more and more despair. More people were dead. They found George Donner dying because his injury on his hand had become very infected, but others were in surprisingly good health, and I'm sure by now you can figure out why. Over the next month, 4 different rescue parties did everything they could to bring back the surviving members of the Donner Party. In the end, 46 of the original 87 people survived. The rest died at some point during the journey. And many of the survivors not only suffered from the physical effects of the journey, they lost toes and fingers to frostbite, but they were also mentally traumatized. Never, never, never at the start of this journey would any of them believed that some in their party would have to resort to cannibalism to survive, or that they would have to watch others basically eat their friends. All told, nearly half of those survivors had participated in cannibalism before they were rescued. As news of the tragic journey spread, people were both alarmed and captivated with the tales of the arrogance, the treachery, cannibalism, murder. Newspapers spread details far and wide, and fortunately, one good thing came out of this. The Hastings Cutoff was soon neglected as a potential route west. It was clearly too difficult to replace the California and Oregon trails, and the macabre ending of the Donner Party didn't help to instill any confidence in this cutoff. However, this story of the Donner Party didn't really slow down the number of people deciding to head west and hoping to strike it rich. And while many of us hear the name Donner Party and it conjures up these grotesque images in our heads of cannibalism, starvation, death, there is at least one triumphant story from the rescue attempts, that of John Stark. Stark was part of one of the rescue teams in early March 1847, and he and two other men had encountered a small group of the Donner Party. There were 11 survivors in this one little group, and it consisted mostly of children. The two other men each took one child and began heading back down the mountain, but Stark, who was a very tall, very gruff, burly man, very strong, looked at the remaining 9 people and decided that they were all going to get out of there. He wasn't going to leave anybody behind. So the few adults that were in the group, he roused them, he urged them to get them to their feet and help the children down. As Stark, quote, took to carrying 2 of them at a time for a few yards, then setting them down in the snow and going back for others. He continued the grueling process all the way down the mountain and eventually led all 9 of his charges to safety. Speaking of the incident years later, one of the survivors credited her rescue to nobody but God, Stark, and the Virgin Mary, end quote. One can only wonder what would have happened, or if the Donner Party's journey would have been as well-known or sensationalized, let's be honest, if they had heeded the advice of James Reed's friend, James Clyman, who, again, was dead set against them taking the Hastings Cutoff. Also, another interesting fact about this entire saga is the fact that Abraham Lincoln almost joined James Reed on this journey. He and Reed were friends, and Lincoln had actually helped Reed with some financial dilemmas just before the group was set to leave Illinois. The only reason why Lincoln didn't go is because his wife objected to the idea, and he instead chose to remain in Illinois and eventually began his career in politics and was, as we all know, elected as the 16th president of the United States. All right, friends, with that, I'm going to take a short break, and when I come back, we'll be diving into the 1999 film Ravenous. Hang on tight. I'll be right back. Okay, friends, here we are. I hope you're as ready as I am. In 1999, the Fox 2000 studio had a movie in production. It had been pitched as a black comedy, as a western, perhaps a bit of a horror film, and basically it was just a medley of different genres, and that movie was Ravenous. It told the story of 19th century U.S. soldiers at a pretty remote army base in the Sierra Nevadas. These soldiers are eventually forced into a battle of good versus evil after encountering a nearly frozen stranger one night who turns out to be a sadistic, predatory cannibal who believes that consuming human flesh cures you of any ailments and makes you stronger by supposedly absorbing the power of the person you consume. And friends, I know this movie isn't going to be everyone's thing, but it is so underrated and funny and bizarre. And given the subject matter, it's definitely grotesque at some points. But in my opinion, to be able to pull off all of that in the same 100 minutes is a feat unmatched by many others. I mean, no one willingly wants to sit down and watch a movie about people eating other people for almost 2 hours, but for me, the storytelling, the acting, that's what makes this film about cannibalism so intriguing to watch and almost enjoyable in a weird way. The film opens with a quote by Friedrich Nietzsche and says, "He who fights monsters should look to it that he himself does not become a monster." And then this quote is answered by another quote, an anonymous quote that is only two words, and it is, "Eat me." So from the very beginning, this movie, at least to me, positions itself as a horror comedy. It opens with a bunch of soldiers standing around a table. A citation for bravery is being read aloud, and then we see John Boyd. And Boyd is played by Guy Pearce. I love Guy Pearce. Everything he's in just amazes me. If you haven't seen Memento, watch it as soon as you can. You can thank me later. The film has a flashback with soldiers fighting in the Mexican-American War, including Boyd, who we see slowly sinking to the ground. He's not mortally wounded, but he's choosing to lay down on the ground. So we can assume that he's going to pretend to play dead and is basically being a coward while his men die around him. The film then switches back to Boyd receiving a promotion to captain, and he's clearly being rewarded, but all we have seen is him be a coward, basically. The men then sit down, and I hate this part so much because they all begin to eat very noisily, and you can hear silverware clanging and chewing sounds. It's gross. I absolutely hate the sound of people eating. I know it's a thing, and I know that in this film, it's intended to be like that. It's intended to sound almost ravenous and uncontrollable, and that they can't do anything except cut into these extremely bloody steaks that are on their plates. Boyd is sitting there looking at his food, trying to eat it. He picks up his knife and fork and goes to cut into it, and then he begins breathing really heavily. And then it cuts back again to the battle where Boyd is laying down and he's just covered in blood. Boyd's commander, General Slauson, knows that he's a coward, although we don't exactly know why yet. So after his promotion, Slauson basically exiles Boyd to Fort Spencer. And in the film, General Slauson is played by John Spencer, who you probably, or at least hopefully, know as Leo McGarry from The West Wing. And side note, this was actually John Spencer's last feature film before he passed away in 2005. But again, General Slauson knows that Boyd is a coward. He tells him he wants him nowhere near the other soldiers. And so he begins his journey to Fort Spencer. He's being escorted by one of the fort's Native American scouts, a woman named Martha. And when he arrives to the fort, he basically sets up his room, and then we get another flashback, finally showing us what happened when Boyd was playing dead. We see the minutes before he decides to lay down on the ground. He's like basically a deer in the headlights. His men are being massacred around him, and he just stands there, not doing anything, not fighting back, not leading, not helping his men. And then this is when he slowly lays down on the ground and pretends to be dead. And you can hear his men yelling his name, screaming as they die around him. The film switches back and we see Boyd with his new commander, Colonel Hart, who is played by actor Jeffrey Jones, who, in case you didn't know, is now a registered sex offender, so that's just lovely. Colonel Hart seems nice enough. He's mild-mannered. He is more of an academic than a soldier. He has his books. He likes to read. He studies a lot and tells Boyd that you kind of need a hobby at the fort because there aren't a ton of responsibilities. It's more just a checkpoint for travelers making their way across the mountains. And at one point, he's taking this knife and trying to open a walnut and grunting and groaning and can't get it open, and then goes and gets one of his really big books and slams it on the walnuts to crack the shell. And After this, Hart then takes Boyd through the others who live at the fort. They are definitely the most random kind of motley crew group of soldiers ever. And there's also another Native American scout who lives there, a man named George, who is Martha's brother. The fort has a light crew. There's only 8 people. They're led by Colonel Hart. There's also Major Knox, who, quote, never met a bottle he didn't like, end quote, and is basically the fort's doctor. There's Private Cleaves, who is played by David Arquette. He and George both tend to spend most of their time partaking in herbal refreshments, and who Colonel Hart referred to as over-medicated. And they also have a man named Private Reich, who is the fort's quote-unquote soldier and played by Neil McDonough, who is one of those character actors who he's literally in everything and always seems to do a really great, believable job in whatever role he's in. I really enjoy watching movies with him. And the first shot of Neil as Private Reich is him standing in a rushing river, which I can only assume is absolutely freezing because they're up in the mountains, and he's screaming. It's almost like he's in there screaming, forcing himself to stay in the water as long as possible and just prove how tough he is. It's funny, but it's also like, yeah, I know guys like that. Colonel Hart also talks about Private Toffler, who is very religious and is referred to as the fort's personal emissary from the Lord. And as Boyd eventually goes outside, he's taking in his new home. He's staring at the frozen, snow-covered wilderness in front of him. And his mind starts floating back to a conversation that he held with a superior about how he survived the battle. And because he played dead, he was buried, so to speak, basically stacked in a pile of dead bodies, laying there with his commanding officer's half-shot-off head in his face and his blood running down his throat. Boyd tells this man that he felt different, something had changed, and then it shows him climbing out from underneath this pile of bodies, which is something that I think would seem almost impossible just given the amount of weight on him, but this also goes to display this newfound strength that he had, and it's implied that it's from the blood that he had inadvertently consumed. So because of this, he was able to sneak around and seize control of the Mexican compound that he was inside, and showing a brief display of bravery. And because of this, he was able to help the U.S. Army win the battle, and so instead of being executed for cowardice, he was promptly promoted and awarded for his so-called heroism, and then shipped the heck out of there to save face, because how would it look if Army leadership punished the man who won the battle for them, basically? At this point in the film, Cleaves and Martha are sent out for a supply run, so the number of people left at the fort is 6, and one night after dinner, Boyd is caught looking at his medal by Colonel Hart, and Hart asks him what he got it for. And at this point, Boyd doesn't lie. He knows that everything is a fake, and he replies and says, cowardice. Hart offers to have Boyd join him for a drink of Major Knox's bourbon, since Knox just passed out drunk. It's apparently a ritual that he has every single night. And as they raise their glasses, Boyd is startled by a man looking in through the window. So they rush outside to find a man who is nearly frozen, collapsed on the ground. They bring him inside and work quickly to warm him up and try to revive him. And once his body is warm again, they place him near a fire, cover him with blankets, and allow him to get some rest. And when the man wakes up the following day, Private Toffler gathers everyone in the room except Knox, who of course is too busy sleeping off a hangover, and the man introduces himself as F.W. Colquhoun, who is played by Robert Carlyle. And again, Robert Carlyle is another actor that I just can't get enough of. He's more famously known for his work in Trainspotting and The Full Monty, but I think he is so stinking talented. He is funny, he is frightening. And I'm saying it right now, if this film had been put in the hands of lesser actors than Carlisle and Pierce, I don't think it would have worked as well as it did. The soldiers ask Colquhoun, who is a Scotsman, what happened, how he came to be out there, stranded in the mountains, nearly dead from starvation and hypothermia. And Colquhoun begins to spin a tale about a group he had been traveling with, led by a man called Colonel Ives, a military man. They were heading west, and much like the Donner Party, Ives, quote, professed to know a new, shorter route through the Nevadas, end quote. Clearly, this is a reference to the Hastings Cutoff. The group of six soon found themselves snowbound. They took shelter in a cave, hoping to wait out the storm, just like the Donner Party did, by huddling in the cabins and their makeshift tents. But they soon found themselves trapped, and they were trapped for 3 months and were slowly starving to death, just like the different groups of the Donner Party. Colquhoun goes on to say how they had no choice but to kill their oxen, horses, even his dog as food, but that only lasted for so long, and then they ended up trying to eat their belts, their shoes, roots, anything they could dig up, anything to prevent them from starving. But they were starving, because belts, shoes, things like that, obviously it's not nutritious and it's not going to sustain you. Eventually, one of the men in the party dies from malnutrition when Colquhoun says he was out of the cave looking for anything edible. But when he came back to the cave, he saw that the others had begun to cook this man's legs, and that the smell of cooking meat that filled the cave was more than he could resist. He was so happy that there was quote unquote food to eat again. He goes on saying that he tried to eat as little as possible, but that the others weren't as resistant to it. They soon ran out of the meat, and Colquhoun noticed how their hunger was more, quote, severe and savage, end quote. They began killing each other off, feasting on the flesh. Colquhoun explains that Colonel Ives was the one who seemed to show the least amount of restraint. And eventually, there were only three of them left: Colquhoun, Colonel Ives, and Mrs. McCready. So Colquhoun confesses that in a moment of cowardice, he fled because he knew that he would most likely be the next one killed. And for a moment, the camera focuses on Boyd, who you see his face almost lighten a little bit, in that he's feeling a little less guilty about being a coward, because here's this other man who's also admitting to being a coward. And then you fast forward to now. Colquhoun has been rescued by the soldiers, but has stated that Mrs. McCready may still be alive in the cave. Colonel Ives may still be alive. So the soldiers decide to set out on a rescue mission. And before they leave, George confronts Colonel Hart and Boyd about an old Native American myth about the Wendigo. George says via a translation from Colonel Hart, quote, a man eats another's flesh, an enemy, and he steals his strength, his essence, his spirit, and his hunger becomes craven, insatiable. The more he eats, the more he wants to. The more he eats, the stronger he becomes, end quote. And Hart is kind of taking this with a grain of salt and asks George if people still do this. And George replies by saying that people eat the body of Christ every Sunday, and then flashes a piece of cloth with a crucifix, Jesus Christ, on it. But obviously at this point, Colonel Hart doesn't necessarily believe in the Wendigo myth, but Boyd is kind of thinking that, hey, this sounds like something that I experienced when I took the Mexican compound. So they're getting ready to leave. There's a shot of Major Knox running past Colonel Hart, who's trying to give him some last minute instructions, but Major Knox is clearly still hungover. He's rushing to the outhouse to vomit. And it's also noted that he's never seen Colquhoun at this point, who leaves with them to go on the rescue mission, offering to guide them so that they can find the cave. And the fact that Knox never saw Colquhoun will also come into play later. At one point, the group takes a quote-unquote bourbon break, and Boyd approaches Colquhoun and asks him about his experience after he ate the man, asking him how he felt differently, if he felt different, stronger, the physical changes in him. And clearly at this point, Boyd is starting to put the pieces together, and maybe the Wendigo myth isn't completely false, because he too felt different after the blood ran down his throat. He felt stronger. That's, again, how he was able to pull himself out from underneath the pile of bodies and take the compound. But before he can continue his conversation with Colquhoun, Private Toffler starts shouting and interrupts the conversation because he's found a bone on the ground, and then immediately falls off a short cliff and tumbles down a bunch of rocks and suffers a puncture wound to his ribs. So the group decides to set up camp for the night. And at one point in the middle of the night, Toffler wakes up and starts screaming. And you can't really see anything until a lantern is lit. And then he basically screams that Colquhoun was licking his wound. So everyone kind of freaks out. Reich pulls out a knife and takes it to Colquhoun's throat because he's a soldier, and he's the soldieriest soldier, and he wants to kill everybody, it seems like. And so Hart and Boyd take Colquhoun outside. He tries to explain that he was having a nightmare and then requests that he be placed in handcuffs because he obviously can't be trusted. And the following day, as they're hiking, George turns to Boyd and calls Colquhoun a Wendigo. When they reach the cave, Colquhoun starts to behave erratically. He's clearly distressed at being back near the cave. He's breathing hard. He's begging them not to take him back inside. Hart calls into the cave for Mrs. McCready and Colonel Ives, but there's no response, so he decides to send Reich and Boyd into the cave to see if there's any survivors. But once those two men are inside, all they find are five skeletons hanging, almost as if they'd been field dressed. And the men soon realize that Colquhoun is actually Colonel Ives and the one responsible for the deaths of the five other people, and that this whole journey, the whole story that Colquhoun told them, everything was a trap. So they start running out of the cave. Things are very tense at this moment. They're shouting for Colonel Hart to kill Colquhoun because they're in danger. They don't know that they're in danger out there, but Boyd and Reich are trying to get out as fast as possible. And all the while, Colquhoun knows that they're going to discover the truth. He begins acting even more erratically, almost like he's having a panic attack. He's humming, he's breathing and huffing and freaking Private Toffler out and displaying some kind of breakdown. And then he starts ferociously digging in the ground and uncovering a knife that he had buried there before he left the cave. Just before Reich and Boyd exit the cave, Colquhoun runs up and stabs Colonel Hart in the stomach. It's a fatal wound, or so we can assume. He then grabs Hart's pistol and shoots George after George throws an axe and accidentally hits Colonel Hart in the back instead of Colquhoun. And then Colquhoun turns to Private Toffler, points a pistol at him, and pulls the trigger, but it clicks and misfires. Toffler, after cringing with his eyes closed, expecting to be shot, opens his eyes as Colquhoun exclaims, "That's so annoying." And that part always makes me laugh just because of how Carlisle delivers that line. And I'll be honest, I've even found myself saying it kind of the way he does in the film at certain points if I'm vocalizing my annoyance with something. It just strikes me as funny. Colquhoun then takes off his top layer. It's kind of like a cape, and he drapes it over Colonel Hart and then picks up his giant knife, looks at Toffler and tells him to run, and starts chasing him up through the hills. It's all a joke. It's all a game to him at this point. And I do have to mention at this point, the music throughout the movie, it's so bizarre, but it works. It's kind of folksy, almost like a banjo. There's a repeating set of notes, and it sets the tone that this movie is just a little off kilter. It's not your typical horror. It's not your typical comedy. And at this point in the movie, it's a bit faster paced, almost like it should be kind of a happy song, but it's not. The situation is quite the opposite. It's not happy. People are being butchered at this point, but the music is having almost an opposite effect, so it makes everything just that much more tense and that much more effective. Like, it just works, in my opinion. At this point, Boyd and Reich come out of the cave. They're not far behind Toffler and Colquhoun. They spot Colonel Hart, seeing that he's been stabbed and he's dying. Hart tells him to go. And during the chase, Colquhoun catches up to Toffler and kills him off camera, but all we hear is Toffler screaming as Boyd and Reich are trying to find them. They eventually come across Private Toffler, who's basically been gutted. He's dead. And they continue on. They're chasing Colquhoun through the trees. They're spotting him. He's there, and then he's not. And then they chase him up onto a cliff, but he's nowhere to be found. And Boyd tells Reich that he's going to go back. Again, just showing what a coward he really is, and that he's not at all suited for any kind of conflict or any kind of confrontation. But Reich is just pissed at this point. Nobody gets the best of him. And so he grabs Boyd and tells him to find Colquhoun, who then jumps out and throws this insanely big butcher knife that he's been carrying around at Reich and hits him in the chest, and Reich falls backward off the cliff, leaving Boyd to face Colquhoun on his own. Boyd then shoots Colquhoun in the shoulder, but it doesn't kill him. He falls down, and he kind of does these fake moaning, groaning sounds like he's injured, and then eventually he just sits back up and is smiling, and there's just blood in his mouth covering his lips and teeth. It's very grotesque, but very effective. And he stands back up. Colquhoun and Boyd are staring at each other. They're kind of lunging at each other, trying to figure out how to strike. And at this point, Boyd decides that his best option, instead of facing Colquhoun and fighting him, is to jump off the cliff. So he does. He falls hundreds of feet, hits branches, rocks, everything. He's rolling down the side of the mountain, and at one point, somehow miraculously, rolls over Private Reich, and the two men sort of snowball effect roll down the hill. They're tumbling and rolling until they drop into this hole in the ground. Reich dies, and Boyd realizes that he has a severely broken leg. He has a compound fracture. There's a bone sticking out, and he knows that he's trapped. It cuts back to Colquhoun peering over the cliff, kind of whistling, almost imitating the sound of something falling off. Again, kind of funny. And he decides to climb down the mountain. He's searching for his two victims, and you see Boyd in the hole, and he's listening, kind of hearing that Colquhoun is walking around up there. He makes kind of a groan, and Colquhoun's head snaps like he heard it, and he's looking and kind of lurking near where the hole is, and you get the feeling like he knows Boyd is down there, like his senses are heightened almost from being a cannibal and absorbing these other people's strength. So Colquhoun leaves. He goes back to the cave, and you can see him dragging George's body into the cave as he's laughing. Boyd pushes the protruding bone in his leg back in, and sure enough, after at least a few days of sitting in the hole, freezing, starving, doing anything he can to stay alive, eating branches, roots, that kind of thing, he's faced with a choice, and he starts talking to the dead Reich, asking him what to do, and he's trying to work up his confidence to do it, and eventually he starts feeling these flames of desire to consume human flesh. He is only part, I would say part Wendigo at this point, if you want to call it that, but this deep savage desire is taking over. He knows that it'll heal him, so he takes a knife, cuts off a piece of Reich's leg, and eats it. There's absolutely nothing funny about this. It's definitely one of the grosser parts of the movie. And sure enough, his leg heals. He's able to limp back slowly to the fort in the snow. And by the time he gets back to the fort, Cleves and Martha are back, and they take him in and take a look at his injured leg, let him rest and recover. Boyd is having nightmares about what happened. He goes to Martha for guidance, but she's a little hesitant because she senses what he did to heal himself. She's also wondering maybe if Boyd was the one who killed her brother. But she still explains a bit more of the Wendigo myth to him and basically tells Boyd that there's no way out, there's no way to stop it unless you kill the person. At this point, General Slauson and his men arrive, and Boyd tells them his side of the story, and he's frustrated that no one believes him. There's no evidence at the cave, there's no bodies, and there's no skeletons, there's nothing. And there is also a point in the discussion where we don't see it on camera, but he must have told General Slauson about the Wendigo folklore. And General Slauson is basically saying that they need something more believable than this quote-unquote Wendigo belief. And it just makes me laugh because I love John Spencer. He's mispronouncing Wendigo. He calls it Wendigo. And then he yells at his subordinate to stop squirming because he knows that he said it wrong. He just is trying to get it out. He's trying to prove a point. It's probably not that funny to many people, but to me, it is, because it just is. Slauson is trying to get Boyd to change his story, to make it so it's a believable story, so that he has something that he can actually report back to army authorities. And he also tells Boyd that they have brought in a temporary commander, and in walks, of course, none other than Colquhoun, who now goes by the name Colonel Ives. And Boyd looks at him, sees him, and collapses in fear. He's cowering on the floor, and Boyd is trying to tell Slauson that Colquhoun is Ives, Ives is Colquhoun. He's trying to convince anyone who will listen that Colonel Ives is dangerous, and he's the one responsible for the deaths of the other soldiers, for the people in the cave. But they assume that he's delirious, traumatized, something is going on, and it's just further proved against Boyd when he tells General Slauson about the bullet wound to Ives' shoulder. And then when General Slauson asks Ives to show him his shoulder, and there's no indication of a bullet wound, it's just proving more and more to General Slauson and the other men that Boyd is basically out of his mind. So Slauson and his men depart the fort. They're leaving Boyd with Ives. Everyone else at the fort who's there now, Cleves, Martha, and Major Knox, were either away on a supply run or deeply drunk and hungover, Knox. So none of them recognize Colonel Ives for who he really is. They don't recognize him as Colquhoun, as the man who showed up in the middle of the night, frozen. And because of this, Cleves and Martha kind of think that Boyd is the reason everyone is gone, because they have no other choice at this point. And Boyd knows who Ives really is. He knows how dangerous he is, and he's keeping a really close eye on him. He's keeping an eye on everybody else to make sure that they're safe. So he's weakened. He's not really sleeping. He's armed with a knife and kind of just comes off crazy. But we know that he is the only person who knows what is really going on and is the only person who will be able to stop Ives. At one point, Boyd is looking out a window. He's watching Private Cleves chop some wood, and it cuts to him sneaking up behind Cleves and killing him and eating him. But it's all a fantasy. It's all something that is in his mind. It's just trying to convince him to give in to the urge, and Boyd is fighting it as much as he can. One night, Boyd, still keeping vigilant watch over everyone in the fort, he follows Ives and confronts him. And Ives, with kind of a smirk on his face, mentions how Boyd didn't finish, aka he didn't finish eating Reich, but that, you know, he understands because Reich was tough, like, quote, a good soldier ought to be, end quote. Ives is not really threatened by Boyd. He's trying to convince him of the benefits of being a cannibal. He told him of how he used to have tuberculosis, depression, he used to be suicidal, he had these really bad headaches, and was basically in really bad shape. But after being told about the Wendigo legend from a scout, and how eating human flesh could cure his illnesses and make him stronger, he of course said he had to see for himself, so he ate the scout first, obviously, and turns out he was right. The tuberculosis was gone, he felt stronger, he felt more alive, and then after eating the group that he got stuck in the cave with, he felt even more invincible. And Ives knows that Boyd is resisting this urge as much as possible. Boyd says it's wrong, and Ives retorts by saying that morality is, quote, the last bastion of a coward, end quote. He knows that it's only a matter of time before Boyd caves, because Boyd is getting weaker and weaker with every passing second. At one point during this conversation, Boyd becomes aggressive and tackles Ives and tries to kill him, but Martha and Knox stop him. They place him under arrest. Martha goes to wake up Cleves, but he's nowhere to be found, and he should be in his room, but he's not. She keeps searching, and she goes over to the barn, thinking maybe he's in there feeding the horses, and discovers that all of the horses are dead. So she runs over to the window. She's banging on the window for Major Knox, screaming that all the horses are dead. And then as she kind of looks up, blood begins to drip down her face. And then Knox rushes outside. They look up and they see the murdered body of Private Cleves lying on the roof. The rest of the movie is basically a game of cat and mouse between Colonel Ives and Boyd. Boyd is confined in his room. He's accused of killing Private Cleves and the horses. And he's still trying to find a way to defeat Ives and make sure that no one else dies. Knox ends up sending Martha to fetch General Slauson, leaving Ives, Boyd, and Major Knox at the fort. Boyd can be seen in his room. He's calling out for Major Knox. He's trying to make sure that he's still alive. Knox basically tells him to shut up and then goes in to see that Colonel Ives is making a stew. And Knox asks if there's anything he can do to help. And then Ives tells him, very tongue-in-cheek, that perhaps later he can contribute. And by telling him that he can contribute, we know that that means that Knox is going to die and end up becoming part of the stew, which is really gross. We then see someone sweep in front of the camera. We don't know who it is, but Knox recognizes this person before his throat is slashed. And you hear these ominous footsteps heading towards the door to Boyd's room. The door opens and it's Colonel Hart. It turns out Ives had coaxed Colonel Hart back from death, and Boyd realizes that Hart is the one who had killed Cleves and the horses. And Colonel Hart tells him what it was like, how he felt as he was dying, how he kind of slipped into nothingness and then woke up to find Ives feeding him, and how by the time he woke up and realized what was happening, it was too late. And then in another moment of the film that always makes me laugh, Colonel Hart says, quote, it's lonely being a cannibal, tough making friends, end quote, after Boyd asks if Hart's going to kill him. So Hart has basically told Boyd that he and Colonel Ives want to include him in their group, but in order for him to survive, he needs to eat. Boyd is then brought outside. Colonel Ives is hacking up Major Knox's body and then asks Colonel Hart to continue on with the dismemberment. And then Ives explains how the fort's location is absolutely perfect for preying on travelers who are doing the whole manifest destiny thing. And Boyd tells him that they're going to get caught, but to avoid suspicion, Colonel Ives says that they're gonna need help, preferably Boyd, for one, maybe General Slauson, but that they're not going to want to recruit everyone because they have, quote, enough mouths to feed as it is, end quote. Boyd is clearly not on board. Ives doesn't understand why he's resisting, because he's felt the power of eating other people and knows what it's like, knows what it can do for him, but he's still resisting. And Ives says that it's not courage to resist him, it's courage to accept him. And then basically makes a choice for Boyd. Instead of letting Boyd make the decision on his own, Colonel Ives stabs him in the stomach, which is going to force him to either die or eat and live. A little while later, we see the three men sitting down to dinner, and Hart says, "Isn't this civilized?" And again, it's funny because it's so off. It's so bizarre that a bunch of cannibals are sitting around eating dinner and talking about how civilized they are. And we see Boyd, he's in really bad shape. He's bloody. He looks like he's dying, because he is. And he's just sitting there bleeding and refusing to eat. And then eventually he caves and eats the stew a la Major Knox, because he knows that this will cure him. And he knows that it will make him strong enough so that he can kill Ives. The following morning, Boyd looks much better. He's no longer on the edge of death. He's recovered pretty much. And he's talking to Colonel Hart and says that he needs some fresh air. And Hart asks him if he can be trusted. Obviously he can't. But Hart uncuffs him anyway. And obviously Boyd is looking for any way to kill Colonel Ives, but Hart, again, I think he really is just kind of lonesome for companionship, wants Boyd to stick around, and is growing more and more frustrated at the fact that Boyd is not a willing participant in this setup. And it also seems like he's trying to convince himself that continuing on as a cannibal is better for everybody. But then Hart kind of changes his narrative and goes on to say how miserable he is and he doesn't want to live his life like this. So now that he's freed Boyd needs to return the favor, and he asks Boyd to kill him, because again, he can't go on like this anymore, and he asks Boyd to do it quickly. So Boyd agrees. He slices his throat as Colonel Ives is watching through a window, and at this point Ives is furious. He rushes into the building. He and Boyd fight briefly, but then Ives escapes outside, and now it's time for the final showdown between these two men. Boyd rushes outside. He's searching for Ives, knowing full well that this is going to go one of two ways. Either he wins and kills Colonel Ives and everything stops, or Colonel Ives wins by killing Boyd, and then Ives gets to set up camp in this fort and move forward with his plan to prey on any of the travelers that pass through the fort. As Boyd calls out for Ives, there are now brief, occasional flashes of Colonel Ives standing in front of a fire with a cross on his forehead, and the cross is blood red. It's definitely setting the tone, indicating, at least in the film, that maybe cannibalism is akin to a kind of religious devotion, almost like it's a full devotion in the ways that others are devoted to their religious beliefs. There is definitely a religious tone to the film. It's not outright religious, but there's a lot of crosses. There's a lot of references to crosses in this film. These flashes of Colonel Ives are very striking and horrifying, and definitely evokes feelings that Colonel Ives is evil and Boyd is good. Boyd approaches the fire pit and Ives crashes through the ceiling. They start to fight. Boyd stabs Ives with a pitchfork. Ives stabs Boyd in the stomach with a knife. There's a lot of blood, and their injuries are ones that would make a normal person fall to the ground. But at this point, they've both been strengthened by eating the stew with Major Knox in it. So they have almost this superhero type of strength to them. And it's clearly a fight to the death. They're throwing everything they have at each other. After Boyd bludgeons Ives in the face with a log, they fall to the ground. They're wrestling. Ives takes a knife and stabs Boyd in the back. The rest of the roof collapses in on Colonel Ives, and Boyd turns, thinking for maybe a moment that Ives may be dead, but ultimately he knows better. But this does give him a little bit of a head start, and the music has been slowly intensifying during this final battle, and you can barely make out chanting. It's repetitive. It's scary, I think. And you can barely make out the words, "Save our soul." And it's just on a repeat. It's cyclical. Ives eventually climbs out of the rubble and chases after Boyd into a barn. And when he gets inside, Ives goes over, picks Boyd up, and pulls the knife out ever so slowly. And then Boyd tackles Ives to the ground, and we see that they land on one side of a very large bear trap that Boyd has set up, and uses Ives's head to push down on the spring and springs the trap, trapping them inside. There is no way to move at this point, and it's a matter of who dies first. And Ives is kind of impressed at this point with how sneaky that was. He actually kind of just groans out that it was sneaky. And again, it probably shouldn't be or wasn't intended to be funny, but I think by now we can all agree that my sense of humor is different. And I think some of the line delivery in this film is absolutely hilarious. And then they're both laying there, and Ives is telling Boyd that if he dies first, he's definitely going to eat him. But if Ives dives first, what is Boyd going to do? Is he going to eat, or is he going to die? And all the while they were fighting, General Slauson and another soldier and Martha were actually on horseback approaching the fort. And if Ives survives, no doubt that these two men and Martha would have either been killed for food or recruited by Ives. We see General Slauson enter the dining hall, and he approaches the fire that has the stew heating up on it, and he doesn't realize that everyone is either dead or dying at this point, and not really realizing what kind of meat is inside the stew. He dips the spoon in, blows on it, sniffs it, and takes a bite. So, unfortunately, even with Colonel Ives dead, the vicious cycle of this cannibalistic depravity may continue. And then it cuts back to Boyd and Ives, and Boyd is literally just holding on as long as he can to see Ives die. And Ives kind of lets out this last final exhale of breath, and he's dead. And for Boyd, the nightmare is over. He has redeemed himself in this final act of bravery, and then he too slips away. He kind of just lays down on top of Ives, and just you can see his whole body relax because he knows that it's over. And at this point, Martha peeks into the barn. She sees what has happened, and that's enough for her. She walks away. She leaves the fort for good. By now, she is completely alone. Everyone she knows is dead, her brother is dead, and she has no reason to stay. And then the film fades to black with an aerial shot of Boyd and Ives trapped in the bear trap. And it's a pretty amazing shot, and I think does a really good job of wrapping up this entire film. I know that this movie is not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but it has gained a bit of a, I guess, more of a cult following since its release over 20 years ago. It's not the best movie out there, but I do feel like it's one of the most original cannibal movies out there, and that's including anything with Hannibal Lecter. And the visuals in this film are amazing. Like I said earlier, in the final battle between Boyd and Ives, the flashes of Ives with the cross painted on his forehead, the fire burning behind him, it's a pretty incredible shot. And it's why I chose to use it for the social media posts for this episode. Plus, the music in this movie is pretty incredible. It's folksy, but it's frightening. And I've never heard anything like it in another film. It also occasionally gets stuck in my head because I've seen this movie so much. And it's unsettling because it seems to be like it's just off its count or something. It's hard to explain, and maybe it's just me, but you listen to it and you feel like at certain points it's going to move on to this next note, and then it doesn't. It goes too soon or too late, and it just makes it that much more interesting and compelling to listen to. Plus, to see Robert Carlyle in another bad guy role is always fun. He's so compelling to watch, regardless of the role, whether he's playing a sadistic cannibal like in this movie, or if he's Begbie from Trainspotting, or in the full Monty, which is hilarious. Dude is amazing. And again, obviously this movie is not a straight retelling of the Donner Party tragedy. It's very, very loosely based on it. It uses some of the details of their doomed journey as more of a vehicle to set up a good versus evil cannibal fight to the death type movie, but I still find it enjoyable. If I see it's on TV, yeah, I'm probably going to watch it. It's also one of the first DVDs that I ever got. I asked for this and Love Actually for Christmas one year, and I got both of them, and I know, quite a pairing. You have a lovey-dovey romantic comedy Christmas movie and then Ravenous. But like I said, not all movies stick with me, not quite like this one. I mean, this one is dark, it's gruesome, it's taboo, but there are these periodic moments of drama and comedy that keep me coming back to it. So I hope that you'll check it out, even if you're only slightly intrigued by what I covered in this episode. Thank you all so much for listening. I do hope that you learned something, whether it's about the Donner Party or just different kinds of films. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. As always, if you have a particular horror film or particular killer that you're wanting me to cover, please don't hesitate to reach out. Thank you, as always, to everyone who is a current Patreon supporter or has purchased something from my merch store or done a donation through my Ko-fi account. It's always so appreciated and helps me make a little bit of a difference in the lives of victims. Again, thank you all so much for listening, and please join me on Wednesday for my next regularly scheduled Mask of Sanity episode. Until next time, stay safe, friends.